Welcome to The Record. This is KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Always good to have you along. You know, there's a new Google ad that shows a man cleaning up after a children's birthday party gone wrong.
I've got to call the pool cleaners, write thank you notes for the gifts, apologize to the clown, buy cleaning supplies, email the Shetland Pony Stable.
And then you see the words, make Google
Sky
do it.
Sky looks amazing. I look amazing. I should take a selfie.
And the words come up, make Google do it.
Did I forget to lock the front door?
This woman's an astronaut remembering her unlocked door.
Hey Google?
Hi, what can I do for you?
I'll tell you what Google wants to do for you. They want to run your home. So there's a bunch of examples of stuff that we like to do. We're not going to get to it. It's inconvenient. Google wants to do that for you. Amazon wants to do that for you. And these two giants are fighting. So here to explain from Seattle's tech news site, GeekWire, Todd Bishop. Hey, Todd.
Hi, Bill.
Before we get to the fighting, let's start with the common ground.
Yes.
Okay. Amazon and Google agree that it would be great to control our homes. Why is that?
Absolutely. I think of the competition and the landscape right now between Amazon and Google, much like we looked at Microsoft versus Apple back in the day. Mm. These were two companies competing to control the operating system for your computer.
Right.
Now you have Amazon and Google both trying to become the operating system for your home.
Good analogy. That's very clear.
And this is manifesting itself in all sorts of different ways. You see that advertisement for Google Home and Google Assistant. That is the primary interface. So much as you had the graphical user interface in the past, now you have the voice interface.
Yep.
And Google has its assistant. Amazon, of course, has Alexa and its Echo products.
So we need to tell people what devices, what home control devices we would be talking about that would be networked.
Absolutely. Everything from your security system to cameras to all sorts of appliances. Gosh, your fridge.
Thermostat,
absolutely. And that really gets to the heart of the stories over the past couple weeks involving Google and Nest, which is known primarily for its smart home thermostat, but has been getting into other areas. And then the competition and really the kind of backstabbing that's going on between Amazon and Google over the competing products. And that's really what's come out just in the past few days about the fact that Amazon has declined to sell new Nest products on Amazon.com, which raises all sorts of interesting competitive issues and potentially even antitrust issues. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. More about that in a moment. Yes. Just before we leave devices, we listed a bunch, smoke detectors and home security thermostats. Amazon spent more than $1 billion on this smart doorbell maker, Ring. What are we talking about there?
Ring is a company that actually...
That's part of this, right?
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. It makes a video doorbell, but it's also getting into home security and was slated and still is slated, presumably, to come out with its new home security system later this year, which is interesting because there really isn't a native Alexa home security system apart from the Amazon Cloud Cam, which relates to the whole Amazon Key thing, which is a whole separate thing. But the Ring acquisition is interesting because that essentially puts Amazon in much more direct competition with Nest and Google.
And how much of this stuff have either you tried out personally or your staff at GeekWire?
As much as we can. Obviously, the Echo and the Google Home. I have a Cloud Cam at home. My wife would not let me test the Amazon Key. Too creepy for our house.
Mm.
But, you know, that is really something we try and test as much as we possibly can. And frankly, I know that there are privacy concerns out there among lots of people, and that Amazon Key service, which is the one where the Amazon service actually opens the door for the delivery person.
Yeah, that's another level of privacy
concern
beyond the I'm sending my data to faraway corporations.
We feel
it's not just the Bishop household. We feel a creep factor about our front door for good reason.
Yeah, people like to say Jeff Bezos not only has your shopping list, but now he has a camera inside your house and, frankly, the key to your front door.
Like, yeah.
What kind of access are you willing to give them? Now, a lot of that is hyperbole and how that's stated, but, you know, in reality, that's what they have.
And where does this lie between crucial to Amazon's future and just one of a thousand lines of business?
This is a great question. I think it's key. And here's the reason I think it's key. Jeff Bezos has talked about the need to develop a core business beyond their existing ones, which are their e-commerce site, their Amazon Web Services, and one or two others. The whole idea is to develop a core business beyond that. I'm convinced that Alexa is that new core business. In fact, the phrase that he uses is dreamy business. The whole idea that it meets customer needs, creates a great business for the company. I think Alexa is really, really core to the future of Amazon.
And the whole home security possibility, home control possibilities that come with it.
Right.
And the operating just, system for your home.
Right. And the security is just one element of that. And but Alexa, in its many variations, is really core to Amazon, which is why one reason, this is another tangent, but it was fascinating to see Amazon strike deals with PC makers to get Alexa integrated into Windows PCs, the ostensible home of Microsoft Cortana, which is a whole other story. I mean, it's just this entire landscape is really interesting right now. And I think there are lots of fascinating analogies back to the PC era, the beginnings of the PC era, when you had the browsers battling it out on top of the operating systems. I don't know. Maybe I'm too much of an old nerd here, but it's really interesting to see this new landscape and this new frontier playing out in a very similar way.
By the way, regarding Alexa, I know it's an old joke that it sets off devices. I don't know how true that is. I know it's a joke, but maybe we should call it the Echo. I don't know. Is that just no one's ever going to call it that again?
Whatever you want to call it,
yeah,
Bill.
Okay. So now let's get to the Amazon and Google and fighting and antitrust.
Yes.
Because I have heard that Amazon has stopped carrying new products from Google Nest, or Google Nest stopped selling its stuff on Amazon. What's the fight?
Essentially, Amazon made the decision to stop selling new Nest products on Amazon.com. And at that point, Google said, okay, well, we're not going to sell any Nest products on Amazon, you know, take that. And so that is the latest salvo between these companies. But this dates back to a previous conflict from last year, which we talked about, which was YouTube on Amazon's Echo show,
the visual
the
version
visual
of
show,
Echo,
right,
yeah.
And then also the Fire TV devices that Amazon has. Google told Amazon that it could no longer use YouTube, which you talk about antitrust, you know, it's sort of wielding your power against the other company, because obviously YouTube is the de facto standard for online video in many ways, especially for user-generated content and increasingly commercial content. And so to not have access to that on the Fire TV or on the Echo Show is meaningfully damaging to Amazon. And so you've got these two companies really battling it out. You have to ask yourself, you know, Amazon likes to say they start with the customer and work backwards. That's their famous line. Are they really starting with the customer and working backwards to a decision when that decision is to basically, I guess, retaliate against a competitor? I don't know. And that's where you start to say, what are they doing here, and in whose interests are they acting?
It used to be that when the word antitrust came up, we would say, well, Amazon is just giving its shoppers tons of options and prices are not going up, so this is not an issue. But when you get into potentially preventing, I mean, you could say this about Google, maybe preventing rivals from gaining a foothold in a market. Antitrusty.
And to be clear, I am not a lawyer. That said, I do know that first the government or whoever else has to prove that you have monopoly power,
right,
and then that you've abused that monopoly power, for example, by taking a market sector that you're strong in and using that to gain entry and to gain an advantage over competitors in an adjacent market. Yeah. So it sure sounds like this.
I want to ask one more question to you, because Washington State just became the first state to approve net neutrality rules in defiance of the Trump administration. First, could you briefly remind us what net neutrality is?
Yes, it is the notion that all legal internet traffic should be treated equal. So in other words, that internet service providers, Comcast, Charter, all the others, are not supposed to, under net neutrality, give preference or faster speeds to one type of content, such as their own, over another.
And since the FCC specifically, when it did this, specifically prohibited state laws from overriding it, would you call this Washington State action meaningless?
No, absolutely not. I think it takes a stand. And to be clear, what the FCC did was they rolled back these net neutrality protections. And so now we're seeing states around the country say, okay, we need as states to re-implement these protections for our consumers. And Washington State notably, is the first of these states to do that. And because of that, looks to be the tip of the spear, essentially, in terms of a legal challenge to the FCC over these rules. And it's fascinating because if you think about it, the traditional Democratic approach, the Democratic Party approach, mm-hmm. would be essentially to have, you know, centralized government control, something coming out of Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And here you have a very clear states' rights issue coming from Washington State's Democratic governor and a Republican administration essentially imposing this rule from D.C. It's a fascinating turn of events in terms of how it flips the traditional notions of these parties on its head.
So many things have been jumbled up that way lately. This is Todd Bishop. He's with the Seattle tech news site GeekWire, co-founder of that site, and we'd love to have him come with us and make clear analogies like the operating system of your home. And now you know what's at stake. Todd, good to see you again. Thanks.
Thank you, Bill.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're going to talk about the fish that escape, the fish that swim between here and British Columbia, the fish from that other ocean. Stay tuned. On KUOW, it's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. This week, our state banned the farming of Atlantic salmon in Washington waters after the current leases run out. But we don't just live with Washington state water. Fish swim right past that border between here and Canada. So will our British Columbia neighbor join us in banning Atlantic salmon farming? We ask Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
No.
Yeah, that's the answer. BC is not banning Atlantic salmon.
Yeah, there's 10 times as many Atlantic salmon fish farms here on the BC coast as there are in Washington. I think your count is 10 and ours are 100.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a dozen light leases that are coming up in June, but the government is being very careful what they're saying about it. The BC government position, articulated this week by Lana Popham, who's our agriculture minister and in charge of aquaculture, she says that the British Columbia government is skeptical about fish farming in the open net pens in the water. In the long run, it would like to see on-land farming, so essentially the fish would be isolated from the marine environment, but that British Columbia is going to proceed on its own basis. It is not going to take the lead from Washington and ban them outright. They're still studying the matter.
As you know, and our listeners know, thousands of Atlantic salmon have escaped from their pens down here. What do the farmed fish supporters in BC say about the danger of non-native salmon outcompeting your locals and introducing disease?
They say that precautions are better here, that escapements are much smaller. There's only been maybe 100 or so, they say. And they point to, I think, what really drives policy on this side of the border. There are 100 fish farms. Their economic activity associated with them is about 6,000 jobs, $1.5 billion in economic activity, $500 million Canadian in annual exports from BC. In fact, it's our largest agricultural export. And although the native community is divided, and this is the real dilemma for politicians, some natives are involved in fish farming. They have investments in them. The corporations own the fish farms, and others are totally opposed. So it's a very, very divisive issue up here. There certainly are calls to shut it all down, just like happened in Washington State, but I don't think the political will is here in BC to do that yet because of the size of the industry and the number of jobs that depend on it.
Okay, so you said maybe the fish could eventually be farmed on land instead of
yes.
out in open water. Do you think, you've covered this issue for a while yourself, Vaughn, do you think that there will be significant reform, changes, safety improvements, or is this just a little talk that we got to have right now because of a spike in urgency?
No, I do think that in the long run you will see an economic push to move the farms out of the open ocean and onto the land. But economically that would be much more expensive, and of course you're selling into an international market here, and competitive pricing is important. So government is encouraging these experiments where they try the dry land farms. But I don't know how long it's going to take to get there. As I said, the government is studying it. They're tightening up standards. They're increasing scrutiny. But I don't think they're in any great rush to I certainly can't see them shutting them down altogether. They may shut down one or two or fine them for punitive reasons. There have been some recent recent other issues involving the health of wild salmon. But as I say, I don't think they'll shut it all down. They may remove some of the more contentious fish farms from a particular area on the coast where native Canadians are fiercely opposed to fish farms. Some of those may close and be moved.
You know, Vaughn, this is not just about food safety and ecosystems. Supporters of the ban here in Washington on Atlantic salmon farming say that it also protects our Pacific Northwest culture and identity.
Yep.
How does British Columbia talk about your culture and identity when it comes to the wild Pacific salmon?
You will find that there are a large number of British Columbia First Nations that agree with that position. In fact, they are calling on the British Columbia government to follow the lead of Washington State, shut it all down. There are a number of activists opposed to fish farming here, including some fairly prominent people who are quoted all the time in the news media, who've seized on this decision in Washington State to say BC should follow. And there is our agriculture minister, Lana Popham, who is a critic of fish farms, came into office as a critic, who was saying, well, hang on, you know, we're not going to do this right away. We've got to take a balanced approach on this. We've got long-term plans, but short-term, you know, as I said, they may close a few fish farms to make an example of them, but I can't see them shutting down 100 fish farms anytime soon. And in fact, what? It's about 7 years in Washington State to phase out all the ones there, correct?
Correct. 2025, the current leases run out.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we've got leases, as I say, that run out in June. So the government could take action here on a few of them quickly, but even that is up in the air simply because of the impact on jobs, investment, and exports.
There's a border between Washington State and British Columbia, but sometimes...
Not one that fish recognize.
not one the fish recognize, exactly. Vaughn Palmer, columnist at the Vancouver Sun. Good to talk with you again, Vaughn. Thanks.
Bye-bye, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be right back. Join the conversation on Twitter right now, at KUOW. Allegations of sexual misconduct have emerged against prominent local writer Sherman Alexie. Many of the women who've accused him of inappropriate behavior are also members of the Native literary community. And they say the publishing industry's approach to Native writers is part of the problem. KUOW reporter Liz Jones has more on this unfolding story.
In Sherman Alexie's adopted hometown of Seattle, the whisper network around him existed for years. Women writers told each other about inappropriate behavior or unwanted advances. One who's now come forward publicly is Alyssa Washuda, a writer and member of Washington's Cowlitz Indian tribe.
The silence was really destructive to me. It was destructive to my health. I was fearful for my career.
Washuda is one of three women who accused Alexie of unwanted sexual advances in an NPR story this week. According to NPR, several more women also recounted off-the-record stories suggesting Alexie used his power and celebrity to try to seduce them. Women who often felt they needed his favor to be recognized in a challenging literary environment.
Sherman Alexie's work and voice and approach seem to be considered somewhat of the gold standard, and we are all considered sort of in relation to him in a certain way.
Early in her career, Washuda says Alexie told her he could have sex with her if he wanted. Another time at a conference, he sent her photos of a hotel room bed with condoms on a nearby table.
I don't want any young woman to be in that position that I was in ever again with Sherman Alexie, where, you know, I was sitting in a bar and he was telling me that he could have sex with me and that I just had to endure it and not make any waves because it felt that important for my career.
Washuda places some blame on a publishing industry she says put Alexie on a pedestal and enabled him to act as sort of a gatekeeper for other Native writers.
Publishers and agents and book critics can all look at this and see that for so long, one writer has had a disproportionate amount of their attention.
Alexei did not reply to numerous requests for comment, but did recently issue a statement of apology. Alexei grew up on the Spokane Indian Reservation, and his work centers on Native life and struggles. He's an icon and a celebrated success story within the broader Native community, where many are now grappling with these allegations.
It's also going to take us to really ask the uncomfortable questions.
Kalina Lawrence is a 25-year-old artist and member of the Suquamish tribe. She's also an activist who speaks out about violence against women. One question Lawrence wants raised in her Native community is their role in elevating powerful voices and how to hold them accountable.
And I think it's really difficult because we're just so eager to have representation that sometimes we're willing to sacrifice the imperfections just so that we're at least seen and heard.
Lawrence is also optimistic that her generation is ready to confront some of the Me Too issues in Indian country and a silence that has spanned generations.
It's a big, huge, 10-foot wave that we're standing here looking at.
Sarah Marie Ortiz is a Native writer and a longtime friend of Alexei's. She calls the allegations against him immensely complicated. In her view, the Me Too movement has created a blueprint that doesn't fit Native traditions or culture.
We have old systems of restorative justice and different processes that have nothing to do with social media and have nothing to do with the often punitive, often repressive and dehumanizing thing that happens in courtrooms and in the court of public opinion.
Ortiz also sees this moment as an opportunity for others and for herself.
If anything, don't want to underestimate my own agency or voice or power as a Native woman in calling upon our Native men, but our men in general, to just be better and to be more vulnerable and more honest than ever before, because that is what it's going to take.
I'm Liz Jones, KUOW News.
And Liz is in the studio with me right now. Liz, NPR published a piece on this yesterday that referenced many more women who requested anonymity to talk about what happened to them. What did you encounter in your reporting?
Well, Bill, as the story started to come out, we spent the past week on the phone with local Native writers, Native women, also non-Natives involved in the literary scene. Anne Dornfeld, reporter, KUOW reporter, also helped out with this reporting. And we were hearing a similar reaction from people, many sad and angry, but mostly not surprised. And not because they knew about the sexual harassment accusations, but more because it fit what they knew of Alexei's character. As one writer told me, who's on good terms with Alexei, I knew he was vindictive and cruel, but I didn't know it extended to this. And being mean is certainly not a crime, but it just adds a shade of context to this pattern. One question that repeatedly came up talking to people is, what made this possible? What systemic factors in the publishing industry or in the Native community kind of gave fuel to this situation? So we tried to get to that a bit in our reporting, but this is a much larger conversation that I know you on the record are trying to convene with Native women and others in this community. So That's great and that's appropriate. But it's been a tough story. A lot of people really didn't want to talk to us on the record or only wanted to talk on background. And not just people who were accusing him of certain things, but other Native writers who have been in his orbit and have more insight just about the influence that he has had on Native literature and what that's meant for them and for others. Just a lot of people really not wanting to speak out quite yet.
One of the women who did go on the record is Alyssa Washuda, and she says the publishing industry gave a disproportionate amount of attention to Sherman. How did that affect her career?
Well, first I'll say her career... It's a career she's been proud of so far. She's 33. She's had two books published in small press. Her first book was a finalist for the Washington Book Award. She's currently teaching English at Ohio State University. So she's had a good career so far, and she's young. In 2013, when she was working on her first book, she was told by non-Native people in publishing to do anything you can to get Sherman Alexei to write a blurb for your book, to get him to come to your reading, to get him to have some influence. And Washuda is not the only writer who told me this. So he's seen as something of a gatekeeper, and his endorsement of other Native writers could really help influence their mainstream success. He's also seen as someone who is not doesn't like to share the spotlight, who is at times disparaging of other Native writers, or who could have done much more to promote others. And the effect of him getting the lion's share of attention meant others were marginalized. At least that's according to some of the writers that we have spoken to, including Alyssa Washuda. At the same time, these writers were inspired and influenced by his work, so I'd wager that you can make a case that Alexi's fame also brought attention to more Native writers, so that case is out there somewhere too. But I think the central issue that these stories are really bringing up is a power dynamic within the publishing world, especially this tiny world of Native writers, and just how to examine that and make changes.
And to be fair, Liz, this prominence of Sherman that you're describing, is that confined to the publishing industry?
No, this is something I'm also hearing about other tribes and Native people grappling with. Some had a love-hate relationship with Alexi's work and his portrayal of Native life. Some I've talked to told stories of him disparaging Native youth in front of a mostly white audience, and they didn't see him as a healthy role model. But people in charge of booking him for tribal events would say, well, we kind of need him. So I guess the last thing I'll say, Bill, is the media's role in amplifying voices that represent a certain community. And even on KUOW, we've often let Sherman Alexi be our go-to Native voice. So if we're serious about, you know, our part in changing this culture, we need to examine our own practices as well. And I know that's something we talk about, we internally strive to do, but it's an ongoing challenge for us for sure.
Yeah, true enough. KUOW reporter Liz Jones, who's following the unfolding sexual misconduct allegations against Native author, filmmaker, poet Sherman Alexi. Liz, thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle, and we're going to be right back. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Be honest now. Do you have 2 weeks of food and water and other essentials to survive after a catastrophic earthquake or another disaster? I know you and I want to be prepared. Most of us are not. In order to change that, a family foundation, a writer, and a newspaper tried something different this past month. From Bellingham, correspondent Tom Bonsi reports.
John Stark stepped away from a long career as a newspaper reporter a few years ago. He was enjoying retirement in Bellingham when the phone rang last spring with a freelance offer. A local foundation wanted to commission a writer to imagine realistically what life would be like in Bellingham during and after the big one.
Then the ground lurched sideways. I fell hard, landed on my right side. I dropped the phone and let go of Daisy's leash without meaning to. She ran away. I managed to get onto my hands and knees as the ground beneath me heaved in slow motion, watery swells rolling me first one way and then the other.
That's Stark reading from chapter one of what would turn into a 27-chapter novella. It was serialized over the past month in the Bellingham Herald.
I actually had a first draft where we actually had looting at the supermarket and guns drawn and shooting and all this kind of thing. And it was a lot of fun to write. I thought it was pretty exciting. But when all was said and done, I realized that it was not only not realistic, it was also not constructive to lead people to expect that kind of thing.
Stark revised that scene and others after consulting earthquake and disaster experts. They told him emergencies tend to bring out the best in most people. Stark says the hurricanes that swamped Texas and Puerto Rico, California wildfires, and a damaging earthquake in Mexico happened while he was writing. They informed his story. For example, a scene of neighbors banding together to fight a house fire.
No fire trucks were in sight. I heard sirens in the distance, but they were likely headed elsewhere. Other fires lit the sky, to the north, the west, the east. My terror at that moment was the worst yet. I would have run if there'd been anywhere to run to. Then a big black pickup truck rumbled up. It was loaded with blue water barrels. They must have pumped it out of the creek somehow.
The fictional characters also spend a lot of time scrounging for food because disaster relief is slow to arrive, as is likely to happen in real life. The River Styx Foundation in Bellingham conceived and funded the Imagining the Big One project. Foundation Director Heather Flaherty says they were concerned by lack of preparedness and wanted a novel way to engage people.
It seems like the facts are not working, or they're working to a point, but then how do we get people to take action? So how can we draw people in a way that is interesting and fun, and we educate almost as a head fake that you're learning through entertainment.
Flaherty and Stark say they're delighted with the response to this storytelling approach. Readers emailed or commented they were inspired to take steps to improve their emergency kits. Independently, an emergency manager in Grays Harbor County, Washington, started writing a similar story of misfortune set in his area. Chuck Wallace has finished the first two chapters of what he envisions as a six-chapter online story project. The tale includes multiple earthquakes, a school collapse, and tsunami.
People pay attention to the stories. And when you give them the story, they're not playing on their phone. And it kind of brings things home, and you're not telling them that, hey, the world's going to end today. You're just saying, this is what could happen.
We remember stories way more than we remember factoids.
You could say there's a burgeoning literary tradition here. The online magazine Motherboard used the term reported science fiction in 2016 to introduce a five-part series about the aftermath of a Cascadia megaquake in Portland. CBC Radio Vancouver took the same premise to Southwest British Columbia for a limited-run podcast.
So this is your wake-up call. This is Fault Lines.
All of these projects fold practical tips that you've maybe been ignoring into their stories or in News You Can Use sidebars. I'm Tom Bonsi in Bellingham.
It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. It looks like Ichiro is coming back to Seattle. USA Today is reporting that if he passes a team physical, Ichiro Suzuki will have a one-year contract with the Mariners. Ichiro was a superstar here from 2001 to 2012. Seeing him in a Mariners uniform again would be, well, it would be nostalgic. It would be maybe exciting. He is 44 years old, though. He doesn't play in the major leagues anymore. How might this go? Sports writer Art Thiel joins us from Sports Press Northwest. Hi, Art.
Greetings.
How does that usually go when a team brings back the aged former hero?
Not well. I think a lot of folks remembered when Ken Griffey Jr. came back in 2010, and he had actually a decent first year, but he stayed 1 year too long. His skills left him, and then he left Seattle in the dark of night, had his car towed to the stadium, and drove home to Florida without telling anyone.
Well, really, what's wrong with that mediocrity as long as the team's not paying him like he's still a star? Does that damage the team?
Well, I mean, the object, I think, in baseball is to win, and if you don't have 25 players for that purpose, then you're just kind of fooling around. And that's the thing that comes up, I think, to most Mariner fans, is the Mariners' history with wanting to turn a buck as opposed to turning into a pennant contender is what a lot of fans look at this as, is just another stunt. I don't think it's really a stunt myself. I think it's a patch. They've got injuries in the outfield. They need somebody to come in and just be happy to be a part-time player, pinch hitter. And so that's kind of this little niche deal here, and it happens to have the convenience of a guy who was successful here 6 years ago.
Yeah, okay. So you see Ichiro as a part-time pinch hitter. So is it just middle-aged sports writers who glorify the wily veteran?
No, I think there's a whole lot of fans who gush over such sentiment and nostalgia. I personally don't. If you're into novelty acts, this will be a novelty act. And lots of baseball fans have proven that they are attracted to shiny objects. And this is one of those shiny objects.
Well, then why are the Mariners? You said they're saving a buck. I mean, is that it? Why are the Mariners in this position of just a pinch hitter part-time patch?
Because there is an absolute bankruptcy in their farm system. They have no one ready to play the outfield in the major leagues right now. And that's terrible. This is just embarrassing to have to go to Ichiro, even if this lasts 2 weeks. They're caught in this situation here where they have three pretty good, young, promising outfielders, Guillermo Heredia, Ben Gamel, and Mitch Haniger. All three of them have some degree of small injuries right now, because that is the Mariner tradition to be injured.
Yeah.
So they need temporary part-time help. Typically, you have a AAA player available in Tacoma, or maybe a AA player who's very mature and ready to make the leap. The Mariners don't have those, and so this, you know, going to this end is embarrassing, and it slides the Mariners back into the old stigma that they've had when Howard Lincoln and Chuck Armstrong ran the team, of doing anything to trade on the very thin history the Mariners have of success, you know, going back to either 1995 and the great series against the Yankees, or 2001 in this case, when Ichiro was a rookie and won both the Most Valuable Player Award and Rookie of the Year.
Well, why is the Mariners' farm system so bad?
Because they've made many bad choices over the years in both player procurement and then trading away good players for not so good players.
So they're just inept?
Yeah, well, I think the regimes of Bill Bavasi and Jack Cerenzik really did not bring to the Mariner farm system quality guys. I mean, the one, I think there's two players right now who you could say were farm system guys, and that's third baseman Kyle Seager and catcher Mike Zunino, and I guess Felix as well, as that he's already burned himself out. So there aren't very many guys the Mariners have drafted and developed who are making contributions to the major league club right now. And Jerry DePoto, the current general manager, I think is a very bright guy and has done some good things, but right now he's still suffering the consequences of the misdeeds of the previous administration. So they're shorthanded in, and Jerry's a part of that from the standpoint that he's traded prospects in his first 2 years to get the Mariners to be a potential contender. Well, last year it didn't work because of all the injuries. They only won 78 games and were not in it. And now this year they're in the same division as the world champion Houston Astros, a phrase I never thought I'd say in my life.
Let's get back to Ichiro then. He's 44 years old. He says he wants to play till he's 50. Could an outfielder play until he's 50?
No, not in Major League Baseball. He can play in Japan till he's 50, but I don't think he's going to play in Major League Baseball, because hitting is all about timing and reflexes, and those are the things that go with age. And Ichiro, you know, was just he only got 196 at-bats last year for the Marlins, and they had a very good outfield, including Giancarlo Stanton, who's now a Yankee. But still, there was not much room for Ichiro for a mediocre Miami team, and there really isn't room for Ichiro on any major league team. But one as desperate as the Mariners will trade on his reputation and try to get a few at-bats till people get healthy.
Finally then, Art, assuming you're right and Ichiro doesn't feel revitalized in Seattle, figure out a way to get by on guile and caginess and shock Art Teal and the world. If that doesn't happen, your prediction for the Mariners this season?
I'm going to stick with what I said weeks ago and have written. They're about a 500 team, 81 wins. They won't make the playoffs. They won't challenge for the division title simply because the Astros are that good and the Mariners' pitching remains that bad, starting pitching.
All right. Well, we've all found a way to live with that for a long time. So status quo.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, if you're hanging your hat on Mariners' perennial contention, you are in the wrong town.
Enjoy the mountains instead. Art Teal, good to talk with you again.
My pleasure.
Sports writer Art Teal from Sports Press Northwest. This is The Record on KUOW. Well, maybe Debbie's in the wrong town, but here's what Debbie writes about this on KUOW's Facebook page. While I am a big fan of Ichiro, and it would be fun to cheer him on for one more year, and I'm good with that as a Mariner fan, I just want this season to not be limping along, living in the past, but a banner season filled with fabulous baseball and playoffs too. If Ichiro can contribute, then great. Go M's. Hashtag ready for some baseball. Thank you, Debbie. Thank you for joining us on Facebook. And thanks for joining us on the radio on KUOW's The Record. Back in a moment. We're on Twitter as well, at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Today, University of Washington researcher Ann McTiernan is trying to prevent cancer using physical activity and weight control. When she was 4 years old, McTiernan wasn't eating. In fact, she was diagnosed with failure to thrive. Her new memoir is called Starved, A Nutrition Doctor's Journey from Empty to Full. McTiernan says her early experience in a boarding school was the beginning of her struggle with food, body image, and self-worth.
You know, there was no family around. There were nuns to take care of us, but there weren't that many of them, and they weren't very motherly. I think children at that age, 4 and a half, after having children and grandchildren myself, I really can see you need family, you need mothering, you need good care in order to thrive. And I didn't have that for that year.
What was it? Can you give me a sense of what your daily life was like at that boarding school?
Well, it was like somebody would imagine from an orphanage where, you know, all these children, or in our case, it was all girls, were all lined up. And our beds were in a row in a large room. And we'd get up at regiment like at 5:30 in the morning, and there'd be some prayers. And then we'd file down to breakfast, and I wouldn't eat, so it was not a good situation for me. And then the children would all then go up to their classrooms.
You mentioned that you weren't eating. What was going on with your eating?
Well, I think a child that age they don't purposely stop eating. They don't think, well, I'm going to do this or not do this. I think I was just very unhappy, and I think a child really needs some encouragement often to eat or to eat well. They need somebody to nourish them, and I didn't have that.
I feel so sorry for that little girl, really. Uh-huh. Why did your mother send you away?
She was a single mother. My parents were separated before I was born, and in those days, there wasn't much in the way of daycare. And she, for her own reasons, chose to send me away. And you would think that a child being sent to a boarding school would be from a rich family, but the Catholics kind of took care of their people and didn't charge families that much if they didn't have that much money. So that's how my mother was able to afford to send me there.
So you were sad, you were not eating. Eventually a doctor got you sent back home. What happened?
That's right. When he saw me, when I was about 9 months into this, he saw me, saw that my weight had gone down from the last visit, which isn't supposed to happen with children, and told my mother she had to take me out, so she did.
What was that return like?
It felt wonderful. Felt good to be home, yeah. Because I was home with my mother and aunt, and I would have babysitters during the day, but at least I was with family.
At that age, you weren't resenting your mom for sending you away? Or if you were, it was still good to be home?
I didn't know. I don't think children that age really understand the issue of resentment. I didn't really understand why I was sent here or there. I think I had the feeling there was something wrong with me, that she didn't want me. But you know, I think that's too young to have a whole lot of cognitive processing going on.
And what happened to the book is called Starved. What happened to your eating once you got back home to mom and Margie?
Then there was plenty of food around, and I kind of overate. So I became a chubby kid over. It took me a little while, but I ended up overeating and becoming quite heavy. And starting at age 7, I was home alone in the afternoon. So I overate, and food became kind of a comfort for me, and a comfort and a companion in the afternoons after school. And so I would eat, and you know, eventually became obese.
How did being obese affect your life?
It was hard because little kids, if they're different, if they stick out, then they can be a target. And I was really, you know, I was targeted by other kids. You know, I had some benefits. I was smart, which is a good thing in school. But you know, I wasn't one of the cool kids, and I stuck out by being a fat little kid. And, you know, I'm in the obesity research field now. We don't use the word fat to describe somebody that's overweight or obese.
That word seems to be coming back.
Yeah, but I think people like to own it. If that word's been used against them, they decide, well, they're going to own it. And so that's what I do in the book. I use the word because that's what was used against me. But as a researcher, I would never use that word to describe a patient.
You feel conflicted about writing that?
I did, but I described in the book in the beginning why I did that, because, you know, that's how I was described, how I felt about myself. I felt like I was a fat little kid, so I used the word. You know, so I felt like I was victimized, targeted because of this, but I didn't understand. I wasn't smart enough or didn't have the tools to understand that there was something I could do as a little kid, that I could change it, that I didn't have to be eating all the time.
So anybody can imagine getting mistreated at school is hard. You also write about really wanting a boyfriend.
That's right. When I was growing up in the 60s in Boston, in the working class community, the holy grail for a young girl was to have a boyfriend. then you'd be okay. Then you'd be a cool kid. And so I realized, you know, after reading, seeing what happened with my friends in school and reading teenage magazines, I saw the sort of things you had to do to get a boyfriend. But I wasn't understanding the depth of what you would need in order to have a relationship. I was just seeing the physical things, you know, lose weight, put on makeup, get pretty, that sort of thing. But it is something that helped me turn things around. The problem is I went a little bit in the wrong direction and became anorexic for a while. I starved myself again.
We're talking with Ann McTiernan, author of the book Starved, and you're a doctor, physician, Fred Hutch, University of Washington, and a big part of your life and your work have been around body image, self-worth, right? What has your experience, your personal experience, taught you about that connection?
Well, I do a lot of studies where we're trying to get people to change their diet or to lose weight or to be physically active. And then we look at the effect on health by making those changes. And I'm really able to understand how difficult it is to make those changes. We always say that you are what you eat, but you also eat what you are. So that means what you come from, your family, your social class, your economics, your culture. And to change that eating pattern is extremely difficult. And especially for people who are overweight or obese who've been using food for comfort, it's really hard because we're asking people to make changes that reduce calories or reduce fat. And a lot of times comfort food is high in calories, high in fat, high in sugars. And it's a major change to reduce calories or to change your diet in that way.
Doctor, most people with eating issues don't go into the nutrition field professionally. What made you do that?
I think I came about it sort of roundabout. I was always interested in health. So I think that's how I started, but I feel like I was in training all my life to do something in diet. And the people that I talk to in the nutrition field, quite a few of them have some kind of issue, either themselves or their family. Some of the obesity researchers either have struggled themselves or they have somebody in their family who has, or they might have family with diabetes. Many of the nutritionists have had nutrition issues themselves or in their families. So people go into a field for a reason, and sometimes it is they're all motivated by their background.
I know this is a big question, but what was the key for you personally when it came to changing your relationship with food?
Well, I think as a teenager, it was the goal of getting the boyfriend.
Yeah.
That helped me stop using food as a comfort, and I just went
the other direction.
I
yeah.
ate too little.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't do it for too long. I was lucky. You know, I think I've always had an issue with food. I'll want to turn to chocolate if things are going badly. But I really do have a strong interest in health and staying healthy. And I can see the adverse effects of either being overweight or obese or of not following a healthy lifestyle. So that kind of keeps me motivated.
And you told such a sad story to begin with about your 4-year-old self and being so sad in boarding school. I wonder what your early experiences through your childhood, what your experiences taught you.
Well, it taught me in one way how to be a mother, that I wanted to make sure my children had mothering.
Yeah.
And one of the first things I did was pick a husband that would be an excellent father. And we've been married over 40 years, so I made a good choice. And then to make sure that, you know, I never felt like I was a super mom or anything, but just to think about what children need along the way. And, you know, I'm sure I made a lot of mistakes as I went along, but realizing children need mothering, they need loving, they need that attention. I think my background helped me realize what would happen if they didn't get that.
What is your relationship to food and eating like now?
I don't like cooking, but I'm just very happy with healthy food. My favorite food is vegetables. My second favorite food is chocolate. I have to limit that. But I think it has, you know, my research and my background has helped me realize that food is really there for nourishing. That's the primary purpose. But the added benefit is that there's enjoyment to it also. So you can have the enjoyment part without having a negative effect of malnourishment.
Dr. Anne McTiernan is a research professor at the University of Washington School of Public Health and Medicine and a member of the Public Health Sciences Division at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle. Her memoir is called Starved, A Nutrition Doctor's Journey from Empty to Full. Thanks for listening on The Record today. This show made for you by Amina Alsadi, Anjua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening today. Do it again tomorrow. Talk to you then.